Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And can you guess what we're talking about this hour? It's Lucille Ball, who would have turned 100, as you probably know, because there's been a lot of press around this on August 6th. And we're lucky to have with us a biographer of Lucille Ball. It was an extraordinary person. I didn't know about her link with Buster Keaton. I didn't know how long she had been making movies before she found the character Lucy, and we remember her in I Love Lucy. Our guest this hour says she was probably one of the hardest working actresses in Hollywood. And at one point, she was making 10 films at once, but she somehow never crossed over to become a star. But she never gave up. She had extraordinary perseverance, whether it was about getting pregnant or becoming a major star. Somehow, it took a long time to come together for her. Kathleen Brady is our guest this hour. She is author of Lucille, The Life of Lucille Ball. She's also author of several other books. She, in 1994, the ABC TV movie, A Passion for Justice, starring Jane Seymour, was based on Brady's research into the life of Mississippi journalist and civil rights activist Hazel Brannon Smith. She's contributed opinion pieces about New York City to Newsday and Our Town. Her topics included the New York flawed bid for the 2012 Olympics, corporate and state hostility toward Gotham's workforce, plus shenanigans that compromise the city's electoral clout. She is past co-director of the Biography Seminar at New York University and a former reporter for Time Magazine. Our phone number as we talk about Lucille Ball, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org. One of the pleasures of this job, Kathleen, is I get to do fun things every now and then, and I have spent quite a few hours the last few days watching old I Love Lucy shows and just laughing and laughing and appreciating her even more.
Well, it's true. You know, I tried to watch it very seriously as a scholar and biographer, and I found myself guffawing. And even, I'll tell you, if you turn off the sound, they're still funny.
Yes.
I turned down the sound once to talk to a friend, and it was during the when she was pretending to be a snail, and it was hilarious. So there are many ways to watch this show, and it is a source of joy which we need.
Yeah, we do need. I was watching last night the bit where she goes to Europe with Desi, and, you know, it's classic. You just take those moments when she's trying to eat this dish, first of all, to figure out how to order some meal, and she can't order, and she gets snails, and she can't for the life of her bear to eat them, and she orders the ketchup, and the chef is him. It's just classic comedy.
It is totally classic, and, of course, her great gift for physical comedy, her fabulous expression. She was beautiful while making these crazy expressions, and we all knew exactly how she felt.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, then the Richard Widmark one when they went to Hollywood and she puts, you know, cigarettes in her nose so that she's trying to look like a stuffed head. It's just, I mean, nonstop.
It has elements of Charlie Chaplin with the unexpected cigarettes in the nose, his little forks on his chin doing a little dance. Inventive. There's also, as I was watching a lot of these episodes, there's a lot of tenderness about her. Her interactions with Ricky, with children on the show, she was just really warm to them.
Yes. And that was genuine. She genuinely cared about people. One of her childhood friends told me that Lucille was the first person to help a blind man across the street, whether he wanted to go or not. But there was a great deal of caring there. I think that the fact that those four characters loved each other so much, Lucy, Fred, Ethel, and Ricky, I think that underpinned and held together all the craziness that happened. And I think that's very important. And we do know that, as you say, there was a lot of tenderness there. And I think that contributes a great deal to why we continue to love this show.
I'm always interested in people's beginnings in life, and she had a pretty hard scrabble childhood, didn't she?
She truly did. Her, almost every dreadful cliche thing could happen, and of course, none of it was felt like cliche. Her father died when she was very young, when she was three, before the birth of her younger brother. Her mother remarried and for a while went off with her new husband, leaving Lucille with a step-grandmother who was a taskmaster and disciplinarian. There was a terrible accident with a gun, and a child was injured and killed on their property, which he died eventually of his injuries. And the little town where they lived, really turned against them. And so of course they were poor and lost what they had because of suits coming out of the shooting, and it didn't stop for her.
And she got very sick. I didn't know this about her, that there was a time, and tell me when it was, when she literally had to learn how to walk again.
Yes. I mean, she had rheumatic fever, and that is the story. And as much as I wonder if that wasn't covering up other things, too, but not to be, I believe in this lady, but she... I think that came out of the story was that she was thrown from a cab or a carriage in Central Park when she was here as a model and thrown into the snow, and that she got very, very sick and was bedridden for a long time and had to learn to walk again. And if anybody could do that, it was Lucille Ball.
But you're not sure that's true.
I'm not really sure that that's true. I know that that's the story, and I could never disprove it, but the fact that I could never really prove it either made me put a little asterisk there to, in all truth, in all actuality. I'm not sure that that really happened. I mean, I'm not sure that I know all the facts of that.
Right. What was it that made her think that she could be some kind of bright light in New York City?
Well, I think she came to New York because she certainly wanted to be in show business, and she had the opportunity to study at a dramatic school here. But she was very young. I mean, this was her teenage years, and she was so completely intimidated that she never opened her mouth. And after about 3 weeks, the school said, you know, you are not going to make it in show business. You have no talent. They probably used the word, I mean, they were probably talking about the theater, and you really should go home because you're wasting your money. Now, there was a star pupil there whose name was Betty Davis, and Betty Davis was doing quite fine, was not only studying but was appearing in plays, and Lucy was just like the wallpaper. Didn't really want to give up, and she was also homesick. So she alternated between Jamestown, New York, and New York City for a while. And she, while in New York, she tried to get into some shows and be a showgirl, but she was always fired for being too flat-chested and lacking personality, really. And somebody said, well, you're so skinny, what you should do is be a model. And be a coat model. And that was a real turning point. She worked for Hattie Carnegie, who was a fabulously successful designer. And that made her stay in New York more interesting and more fun, and led to her becoming a Goldwyn girl, actually. So that's how that all happened. She did not think... I don't think she thought far enough to think, I'm going to take New York City by storm. But what she did know when she went to Hollywood was, I'm not going to let what happened to be in New York happen here. I'm going to speak up. I'm going to push myself. And that's exactly what she did.
Isn't it remarkable that the thing we love her for and the thing that was her genius was her comedy? And she spent all of these years with it never really being known. And yet you knew it must have been somewhere inside her that she was very funny.
Well, exactly. And I tell you, first of all, of course, in those years, Hollywood wanted beautiful women, and indeed all women, to be glamour girls, not cut-ups. And but an amazing thing happened. The second or third day when she was in Hollywood, she was on the Golden Lot outside talking to a friend about something that had happened the night before with the typical Lucy, you know, eyebrows going up and gestures and acting out what had happened, and a man emerged from the shadows or from the corner, and he said, you know, young lady, if you play your cards right, you can be the greatest comedian in America. And she thought this was a line. This is, you know, he's a pudgy guy from Texas. Didn't, you know, who was he? Well, he was somebody who had worked very closely with Buster Keaton, and he knew exactly what he was talking about because he'd seen Mabel Normand and all the greats of silent films who worked very hard to be physical because there was no sound. So they, you know, had the expressions and the gestures, and they acted everything out. And here was this, I mean, she would have, if she'd been born 10, 15 years earlier, she probably would have been a great star of the silence. But as it was, she had to wait another 20 years and be a great star of television.
And this character, Lucy, comes from where?
Well, it comes from partly from a radio show she did in the 40s called My Favorite Wife, with the writers were the people who wrote for her in television, including Bob Carroll and Madeline Davis. And so there she played a wife who was trying to help her husband, and trouble ensued. Lucy played a banker's wife. And then she also, as she was, when she, after she was, she left MGM and she wasn't on contract, the same man who told her she could be the greatest comedian in America, Ed Sedgwick, and Buster Keaton, who knew what she could do, got her work at Columbia Pictures, where she made a bunch of, I'll call them, well, not really slapstick comedies, but they certainly involved a lot of comedy. And there she began doing the pratfalls and the hanging from clotheslines and doing the wild things that Lucy Ricardo would eventually do. And when you watch those films, it's like watching Lucy Ricardo emerge from a family tree. You see exactly the talent that she had, and here finally this talent had a place to be.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring Desi into it, because you think of the two of them, actually, and it is this remarkable pairing on television. It's kind of unusual for its time, and together they're marvelous.
They are marvelous, and he was an excellent straight man, and somehow he, possibly because she loved him so much, his personality was a match for hers dramatically, or at least he didn't. Lucy was, you know, in all those films, when you see her, she's a very strong character. She sort of looks like she can take care of herself, and she doesn't really need the hero. And with Desi, I mean, he was a great, he was the perfect dramatic partner for her. I mean, it was like Tracy and Hepburn, but it was, you know, Arnaz and Ball. And so when I interviewed Lucille Ball, she told me that Desi Arnaz was 90% responsible for her business success.
Oh, my.
But he certainly was also responsible for, I think, I mean, not only because of what he did backstage and in running the studio, but he, creatively, he helped her shine.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're going to play some bits from I Love Lucy and a little bit of an interview that was done by Irv Kupson at, in Chicago. And welcome your phone calls, too. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Before we pause for a moment, this is from an I Love Lucy episode dating December 29, 1952. Lucy hires an English tutor. She would like for Desi to speak proper English.
And how is your sister Cynthia? Sister Cynthia is simply scintillating.
Now, Lucy, you're not going to teach our child to talk that way, are you?
I certainly am. From the time our child is born, it's not going to hear anything but perfect English.
Well, honey, it's a very nice thought, but as usual, you will have no logical explanation for doing it the way you're doing it.
What did you say?
You heard what I said.
As usual, there's no logical explanation for doing it the way you're doing it. Ricky, promise me something.
What?
Promise me that until our child is at least 19 or 20 years old, you won't talk to it.
What? What's the matter with the way I talk?
Well, I haven't told you this before, dear, but you speak with a slight accent.
You can understand me, can you?
Well, now, yes, I've learned to listen with an accent. But when we first started going together, it was just... Well, do you remember when you proposed?
Yeah.
Well, it was just a stab in the dark when I said yes. I wasn't sure that you'd ask me to get married or go to a movie.
Do you mean to tell me that I could have gotten out of this whole deal by just taking you to a movie?
Ricky Ricardo. Here, honey, I'll show you what I mean. Now, you take this book and pretend that our child has come.
Oh, that is a very funny bit. I have to get your response to it, Kathleen.
Well, it is. I mean, it is fabulous, and I have been laughing and hoping I wasn't going to mess up the show here because it made me laugh. You know, and it goes to what you said about the tenderness. On the show, only Lucy was allowed to make fun of Desi Arnaz, Ricky's accent, and... you know, for whatever reason, and she does it with such, she does do it with love, and it's funny, and nobody's feelings are getting hurt, even despite what they're saying to each other. A friend of mine told me that her mother had been a war bride and from France, and she came here and struggled with the language, and she said what courage Desi Arnaz had given her, because she could tell that people had a hard time understanding him and his English wasn't perfect, but that they loved him anyway. And it gave her the courage to keep learning and to not lose heart and to know she was going to make friends and it was going to be okay. And it sort of brings a lump to my throat when I tell that story. So it's, that's hilarious, and that's delightful, and it's touching, too.
And a very hard thing to pull off, I think. It's hard to walk that line between not putting somebody down to being able to pull all of this off with tenderness.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, because here she's sort of making fun of the way someone's talking, saying that, on some level, maybe the kid shouldn't hear you talk, but yet it's wonderful, and we're laughing, and we're feeling good, and it's not mean.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
Not mean.
Right.
There is some reason why this show touches our hearts in a way that the Three Stooges, whom I actually came to respect a lot in researching this book, and she appeared with the Three Stooges, Lucille Ball did, but there's a reason why I Love Lucy touches us in a way that the Three Stooges does not. And I think that's a whole, that's something for writers and creators to consider. That gets to the serious study of the whole thing, and we can still laugh as we go along. But there really is a greatness to that show.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think there definitely is. Kathleen Brady, author of Lucille, The Life of Lucille Ball, is our guest this hour. And our phone number, we're going to start going to your phone calls here in a moment. And we have some good emails in, too. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Come in.
Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi, Fred.
What's new, man?
I don't know, but something is. Ethel told me to stay out of the bedroom and wait for her over here.
They must be cooking something together. Lucy won't let us in our bedroom either. She says to wait out here for a pleasant surprise.
Uh-oh.
Now, what do you think this pleasant surprise could be?
Maybe they're leaving us.
No.
Bethel's been acting strange all week.
So has Lucy.
How can you tell?
We're talking about Lucille Ball this hour of the program, and we start taking phone calls now for our author guest, Kathleen Brady, author of Lucille, The Life of Lucille Ball. Our first caller is Jesse in Isthmus. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
My mother is 85. Would that be about the age that Lucy would have been?
She would have been 100 last Saturday.
Oh, really? Oh, that's why we're celebrating her.
Right.
Anyway, okay, that makes sense. So my mother was younger. My mother was watching over my shoulder when I was a kid, and she said something that I had never thought of. She said Lucille Ball had the best legs in Hollywood. I was shocked, you know, because she's so goofy, yet she had this reputation for gray legs.
Well, she was quite.
You might want to know that the whole picture was there.
Yeah, she was quite beautiful, Kathleen.
Well, she absolutely was, and she—I mean, there was a reason that she had movie contracts. It's true that she wasn't as popular or didn't have the punch of Ginger Rogers or Katharine Hepburn, but she was in films, and she was beautiful, and wonderful. Shoulders and in fact, the reason she was hired to work for Hattie Carnegie as a model was because she looked like Joan Bennett, a name we hardly know, and I just muffed. But Constance Bennett was the greatest star of her, like the early 30s, and Lucy looked like her once her hair was dyed. Bleached blonde, and Hattie Carnegie figured Lucy could help her sell clothes to Constance Bennett. And of course, being beautiful was one of the reasons that she wasn't seen. Her potential as a goofball was not perceived because that just was not something beautiful women did at the time. Deborah Messing. You know, Lucille Ball made Deborah Messing possible. But I'll tell you a story. I got to interview Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, you did?
Which was a terrific experience.
Yes.
And I told her that Lucille Ball had said that she, Lucille Ball, did not think she was very beautiful. And Katharine Hepburn said to me, well, was she? She had a wonderful personality, but she wasn't really beautiful. And I thought, well, now what is Katharine Hepburn saying? And then I thought about it and realized that the standards of beauty in the 30s were sophistication and this hauteur. And that's
yes.
not the kind of beauty Lucille Ball had. Even then, she was a sweet sort of girl next door, all-American type. She was not a New York sophisticate and went in type, and when they tried to make her seem to be a New York sophisticate, she came across as being rather hard, which I think is one reason things just never quite clicked in her roles when she was in films.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email that has come in about her beauty from Jeanette. I just watched two films on Turner Classics with a young Lucille Ball as a serious actress and remember that 70 years ago, I had a booklet of paper cutouts with Lucille Ball and her costumes and dresses. As a child, I thought she was beautiful. My favorite way of dressing the cutout was a long silk dress with a knee-length silver fox fur. With her red hair, it was gorgeous. Now, why can't I remember where I put my glasses?
Well, happy hunting. I hope you find that. That would be a treasure.
Yes, it would be. Let's go next to Nita on the road. Hi, Nita.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking the call. I love your show, and I'm driving out of Wisconsin, moving to Akron, Ohio.
Oh.
The perfect, I love your show, so it's the perfect goodbye.
Thank you.
I was calling because I grew up in India in the 80s, and back then we had state-controlled TV, so it was all black and white. There was only one channel, and we had the TV would come on only between about 6 in the evening and about 10 o'clock at night. And once a week, we would all tune in for the Lucille Ball show. And I just wanted to, it used to crack us up, and her humor, and the whole show is, it's just cross-cultural, even in India in the 80s. And the a couple of other points I wanted to make was, you know, back then it was okay to have a goofball woman. And most of the shows nowadays where there's a couple, it's always the woman who is the smart one and the guy who is the dumb one, from Tim the Toolman Taylor to I Love Raymond, Everybody Loves Raymond, and a few other shows that I can't remember their names of now. So it's kind of interesting how that's changed over time. And finally, I just want to make one last point, and that is, it was great that, I'm forgetting his name now, the guy, Ricky, had an accent. And I wish there were more shows on network TV where the people have accents, because I was a professor at UW for the last 11 years, and sometimes students would have trouble understanding my accent, which isn't even that strong.
No, it's not strong at all.
And I think if they were just exposed to different accents, they might, yeah, it's a good thing.
Kathleen.
So that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Yeah, safe travels, Nita. You can still listen to us online.
Yes, I
okay,
will. Okay,
thank you. Kathleen.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, it's I do believe that the show probably had more of an impact in 1950s America than we know in terms of opening us up. A little more than people. Maybe we were a better people than we get credit for, but of course, CBS did not want Desi Arnaz to play Lucille Ball's husband on the show. They felt that the public would not accept a, quote, red-blooded American girl being married to a Cuban or a Latin.
Interesting.
Yes, and they went out, you know, to prove them wrong. And this goes to show that I Love Lucy, I mean, I Love Lucy was many years in development. And so Lucy and Desi went out across the country. And at that point, in big cities, sometimes performers would appear at movie theaters. So for your dollar or whatever you paid to get into a movie, you would get not one but two movies and possibly an appearance by Hollywood stars. And Lucy and Desi were an enormous hit on the road. And they persuaded CBS executives to let Lucy, to let Ricky, to let Desi Arnaz be in the show. But the deal was he could only be on when it was absolutely necessary. Well, then, of course, they made him a band leader, and the writers knew what they were doing, and they made him important in the show. And I also got to interview William Paley, head of CBS.
Oh.
And he said, well, you know, and he had come to respect Desi a great deal, and he said, well, Lucille Ball really fooled me. She put one over on me, got him on the show, and I'm glad that she did. So, yes, I think that, you know, but the truth is, you could never, I love what you played earlier, because making fun of someone's accent today, I was going to say the switchboards would light up. We don't even have switchboards anymore, but the internet connections would fry because people would so object to making fun of someone's accent, which is not a good idea. But it's, yeah, I mean, they're cross-cultural. There's definitely a cross-cultural component to this, and I think that either I Love Lucy taught us all something in the 1950s as Americans, or it showed that we were not completely the bigots that people thought we were. All you need to do is make us laugh and tug our heartstrings, and you know, we're on the right path. Hmm.
So she may have taught us how to listen with an accent, huh?
Well, she might have. She was certainly the first one. I don't know of anybody else who was doing that.
We go to Charlie in Superior next. Hi, Charlie.
Yes, hello. After I Love Lucy, Lucy was in some other shows. One of them was called Here's Lucy, and then I think there was another one called Lucy Show. And some of those were in color. And I'm curious, what are the what is the status now of those shows? Because I see them in reruns, and the picture quality is so bad, and they're edited to bits. Who owns the copyright now, and what is the status of those old shows?
I cannot be sure. I think those old shows are probably owned by CBS. I think one of the things that's happened is high-definition television is posing problems for old shows, including some old movies where you can see the pancake makeup on the performers. So I don't know the answer to that. Those shows there are some wonderful, wonderful bits and scenes in all of those shows. You know, they don't have the power of I Love Lucy, but we still get to see Lucille Ball and Vivian Vance doing some of their great work.
Mm-hmm. We'll play a bit of this, probably not the whole thing. This is from the Lucy Show, April 12, 1965, and we played it because of the radio connection here. Lucy is a disc jockey. She wins a contest to be a radio disc jockey.
Well, now I know what turns on the electric fan, but I don't know anything else. What's that? I'm on the air. I'm on the air. Oh, rubber baby buggy bumper, rubber. Hello out there. This is Lucy. Lucy the disc jockey saying hello out there. Hello to all of you people in Radio Land. Way out there. I'm going to be here all day with all of your favorite tunes, from rock to Rachmaninoff. But first, a word from our sponsor, Spangle Soda Pop. Oh, commercial on the tape. Friends. Yes, sir, Spangle Soda Pop. You really should drink that stuff. And now for some music.
Oh, we're going to listen to her all day long. Lucy won the contest.
Funny. I can imagine it means a lot, you know, as a radio, her radio performance. That's really very funny.
It is very funny. And those of us who've been in radio for a long time can completely understand all of that. We all have everything go wrong sometime. Everything goes wrong and you think about it and you dream about it forever. You just never get over it. What about her politics? There was somebody in the family that was a member of the Communist Party at some point. Was she ever under political suspicion? Did she support any candidates? Was she politically active? Was Desi?
Well, the answer to all that is yes and no, because there's quite a story. Her beloved grandfather, Fred Hunt, whom she loved about as much as anybody in life, as soon as she was making any money in Hollywood, she brought her family out to Hollywood from Jamestown, New York, including her grandfather. Her grandfather was a great supporter of Eugene V. Debs. He believed in the working man and the importance of the working man and his rights. So he got out there and he found out that Lucille, his granddaughter, had not registered to vote, and he said, you go out there and you register to vote, and you register to vote as a communist. And this is what Lucy did in 1936. Well, and then she promptly, that afternoon, she went out and filmed a movie or whatever she did, but she obeyed her grandfather. Fast forward to the McCarthy era, when the House on American Activities was committee was going after a lot of performers and ruining a lot of performers' careers. Nothing was on paper. Everything was by innuendo. All you had to do was be mentioned and as a possible communist supporter, and you were pretty much done for. And names we hardly know today, like Larry Parks, people were ruined. Successful shows, successful stars. So, lo and behold, they look in. Here we have, so there's one person who is registered to vote as a communist. They've got paper goods on one person, and who is it? Lucille Ball.
Oh, my.
So, this was going, Lucille Ball was, on a Sunday afternoon, she was listening to the Winchell show, and Walter Winchell announced that a big star with red hair was under suspicion, and she sat there and said, well, who can that be? Who can that be? Well, pretty soon Desi was telling her, guess what, it's you. They've invited you in for a discussion, and I cannot describe to you the horror that these people felt because it seemed that they were ruined and done for. So Lucy goes to the studio, and she told me when I interviewed her, and also, but I'm sure she said it elsewhere, it was Republican people who were investigating her, which becomes important, and so they were wearing blue shirts. This was unheard of in 1950s America, unless you thought you were going to be on TV. And then you wore a blue shirt.
Blue fascinating.
Blue shirt went, I am going to be on television.
Uh-huh.
So they were out for the publicity. So they asked her about this, and Lucille Ball said, well, I told the story I told you. My grandfather told me to do it. I did it for him. She said, in those days, it was worse to be a Republican than to be a communist. So, of course, this was the height of the Depression. So, but she still was not sure what was going to happen. Nobody from CBS would talk to them and give them any guidance or give them a reading. So they had that night, later that week, a few days later, they had to perform the show. They had a doctor there in case she utterly collapsed or was pelted with garbage or whatever. And Lucy went out there. I mean, it sort of makes me cry because I cannot tell you the terror that she felt. So she goes out there. She manages to get through it. People were cheering her wildly. Desi Arnaz spoke before, you know, in the warm-up, and he said, in introducing her, he said, the only thing that's read about her is her hair, and we are certainly not sure about that. And so she came out, big cheers. Desi was the first person and the only person who stood up to them and said, "You show me, you know, show me proof. Come talk to us. We want to have a free and frank discussion." He was the only one who didn't run for cover to the extent that he could, and nobody could because that was a witch hunt.
Right.
And guess
sure
what?
Was.
They finally went too far when those bullies called up Lucille Ball because, and of course, didn't it seem like something Lucy Ricardo would do, was
yes.
run afoul on the
yes.
House on Un-American Activities.
Yes.
Seems like another stunt. And so that was a very important part of American history. But afterward, Lucille Ball would not so much as vote.
Oh,
isn't
my.
Isn't that the great idea? There are some people, and isn't that the point of fear and intimidation? And but they did. They got her because she thought that she really thought it was over for them. And because there was a pattern in her life, wonderful things would happen. She would get to go live with the grandparents she loved, only to have somebody shot and lose the house. So this is a pattern she was used to, boom and bust, and she thought it was bust. There are one of her friends told me she thought she had probably voted for John F. Kennedy. But it was a really a horrible episode in her life, but it was something that ultimately I think was very useful. It began to break the back of the House on Un-American Activities, and it also was really, in a way, the making of Desi Arnaz because he had done what people began to take him seriously and see his energy and his power and his force.
Right. Isn't that a story? That's a remarkable story.
It's an incredible story.
It sure is.
And it is funny. I mean, not to offend anybody in the audience, but when she said, look, told the Republican congressman in those days it was worse to be a Republican than to be a communist. You know, I mean, I think she was so unnerved she really didn't even know what she was saying. But, you know, at the in the Depression, that was
she
true,
was speaking the truth then, right?
Landslides proved.
Right. Let's go to Nancy in West Bend. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, and a little bit lighter note. Once upon a time, I was watching the Lucy show, and it went past half an hour, and it kept going and it kept going. I did remember that they at one time did travel across the country with a house trailer when he moved to L.A., I think. But this was a movie. It was called The Long, Long Trailer. I have since found it at the library just this week as a coincidence. We've been watching it. It's absolutely hilarious. With them riding in the car in this 40-foot trailer and the unbelievable costumes, and they've just been married. And are you familiar with that?
I am. They made that film on the break, during a break in I Love Lucy production, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was funny, and they, you know, played different characters, and they were still fabulous. It was a wildly successful film.
They were Nikki and Daisy. I actually called up my library to see if I could get this, and I couldn't get it the one in my little town, but I got the in the next town over. They actually had it in file. I didn't have to order it or anything. I would tell everybody just to get it. It was hilarious. It's the same tricks my mother used to do when she traveled out west. Started going down Highway 101 in California and came across to Yosemite, and you saw the parks that they came through. And there's a whole thing about collecting rocks and putting them in the trailer. But my mother used to do it. It was hilarious. I would recommend anybody to track it down.
Thank you very much for the call. We're talking about Lucille Ball this hour. She would have turned 100 last Saturday, August 6. Kathleen Brady is the author of Lucille. I love that name, don't you? Lucille. Lucille, the life of Lucille Ball. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, honey, you don't have to pay them all at once. Look, I got a system. See? We put them all in the Lazy Susan like this, see? Just like that. Now, we spin it around and any bill that stays on gets paid. See? The lucky winner is the Connecticut Light and Power Company.
Lucy, we can't pay our bills by spinning them around on a lousy Susan.
It's a lazy Susan.
She always had these. You know, there were elements of brilliance in all her wacky ideas, too. You could see the mind going all the time.
Yes. And Lucille Ball would be the first person to give a great deal of credit to her writers. Bob Carroll and Marilyn Davis, whom I mentioned. And,
yes.
And then Bob Weisskopf and Bob Schiller, who were both from New York, and they were the ones who brought the suburban New York ideas into the I Love Lucy show. And, of course, America was moving to the suburbs at that point. And so there is brilliance. And, again, I say Lucille Ball would credit her writer. She used to say, I am an actress who has learned how to execute what my writers write for me. And they would always say, Lucy makes us look brilliant. And but really, they also were brilliant.
Yes, they were.
You know,
brilliant writers.
Absolutely. So interestingly enough, when she won her first Emmy, when the show, I think it was the first year when Emmys were first being given, I Love Lucy was there, of course, at a long table, and they won, the show won something, and they did win a few Emmys over the years, and I don't remember which one, but it was early on, and Lucille Ball said at the microphone, there really should be an Emmy for writers, because we owe them so much. And that kind of generosity is, I think, very rare. Now, Lucille Ball would put her writers and everybody in the cast and the crew through their paces and work them very, very hard. She was by no means a softball, but she knew where credit was due, and she gave it when it counted, and they knew it.
Was she a tough person to interview? Did you like her?
I liked her very much. She was a tough person to interview. Even though I tried to be a professional journalist and objective, I was
completely awestruck, and I could not believe I was sitting in the presence of Lucille Ball. But I did something that really helped me enormous. I understood something that Lucille Ball did to a lot of people and was criticized for, because she did it to me. And this is what, I mean, she would basically scare the heck out of you. In those days, you would ask successful women, there was a standard question that you would say when you were getting out your pencils, and partly because it was true. People say you're tough. And why is that? And the woman would always say, oh, they don't say that about a man. It's because I'm strong, blah, blah, blah. Well, I said, it was true. People say you're tough. Why do you think that is? And I'm reaching for my pencil and my pad, and she said, who says that? Who says that about me? I want their name. And she stood up. And I'm saying, I don't know. I couldn't believe it. Oh. She seemed to be, 12 feet tall, and I was getting smaller and smaller. And she said to me, they made workaholic and perfectionist a dirty word. And so, I was completely, I was just so taken aback. I never expected that because this was a pattern. When Desi Arnaz brought in Vivian Vance and introduced her to Lucy and said, Lucy, Vivian is going to be on our show. And Lucille Ball said, for what part? I mean, she had to terrorize everybody else as much as she was probably feeling uncomfortable, nervous, and terrorized. And once she'd done that, everything worked fine. Now, I was told I was only to stay for 45 minutes. That was it. And I was told that several, several times. Well, she let me stay the whole afternoon.
Oh, did she?
Yes, she did. So, I think we had a good time. I think we had a very good I enjoyed it. It certainly wasn't about having a good time. It was about getting a good interview. But I was honored to be in her presence. And I tell you, many, many things, but when I was actually on the way out, I saw her handbag, which looked exactly like my mother's handbag. And I said, my goodness, here's a woman who could buy anything in the world. And she has bought the same handbag possibly my mother's bag was a knockoff. But, this is what a regular American woman would buy for a handbag. And, she had such an appreciation for the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a big part of her talent. And I asked her, I said, you've done so many things that women today are trying to do. You succeeded after 40, and you had your first child after 40, and you married a younger man. I said, how did you do all this? And she said, happenstance. I was trying to do things like everybody else.
He was 6 years younger than she. That was a big thing, huh?
Well, yes. I mean, she, she really was ahead of her time. And again, she didn't mean to be, but it all fell into place for her. There was a great deal of fate in her career, I think, because she really was born both too late and too soon.
Mm-hmm.
Too late for the silence, and it took a long time for television to come along. But even though she was not a big star in the movies, it was no small thing to be under contract to movie studios in the Depression.
Well, I'm glad she was alive, and thank you so much for being with us. It was just a lovely hour. I had the best time.
Well, I had the best time, too. I am honored that you invited me on the show.
Thank you, Kathleen. We're honored to have you with us. Kathleen Brady, and she is the author of The Life of Lucille Ball. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9.
Kisses like no one can. She's my missus and I'm her man. And life is heaven, you see. Cause I love Lucy, yes, I love Lucy. And Lucy loves me.
I love Lucy and she loves me. We're as happy as two can be. Sometimes we quarrel, but then how we love men.
she loves me. We're as happy as two can be. Sometimes we quarrel, but then how we love making up again. Lucy kisses like no one can. She's my missus and I'm her man. I love